Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and we're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 30th of October. Our main stories. After more than 8 years of civil war, the UN tries to kickstart peace talks in Syria. Meanwhile, Syrian refugees in Turkey face the threat of being kicked out. And the Turkish president rejects a vote in the US Congress to recognise the mass killings of Armenians as genocide. Also in the podcast, Iran accuses the US and its allies of stirring up unrest in Lebanon and Iraq. And the England team hacked off World Rugby. It may be a forlorn hope, but after 8.5 years of civil war in Syria, the UN is trying to kickstart a peace process. It's bringing together 150 delegates, 50 from the government, 50 from the opposition, and 50 from civil society. They're meeting in Geneva to try to draft a new constitution. But at the formal opening ceremony, the heads of the government and opposition delegations didn't shake hands, and optimism is not high. Keith Krauser is a conflict resolution expert.
We're not even in a stage where the guns have gone silent yet, and there's still issues of territorial control and fighting. Normally, one sees some kind of interim arrangements, whether it's power sharing or interim governments or interim leadership that are put in place before you go to a full-blown constitutional committee or convention. So this does seem a bit premature.
With more details from the talks, Imogen Folks in Geneva.
Addressing the 150 Syrian committee members, the UN Special Envoy Geir Pedersen acknowledged the challenges ahead. He called for patience, persistence and readiness to compromise. The task, not formal peace negotiations, but drafting a new constitution that could lead to UN-supervised elections. Some analysts question the strategy. Fighting still rages in parts of Syria. Surely peace, or at least a ceasefire, should be in place first. But the UN, over 8 long years, has tried all the conventional diplomatic methods of ending wars. None of them have worked in Syria. This process, if it goes anywhere, is likely to be long and complex. The opening remarks have not been entirely conciliatory. The Syrian government representative praised what he said were the sacrifices and heroic deeds of the Syrian army. The opposition responded saying terrorism could not be stopped with terrorism. Meanwhile, on the ground in Syria, the government is regaining territory, and President Assad, whose future in office was once viewed as impossible, is consolidating his hold on power.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. According to the UN, more than 3 million of those who fled the fighting in Syria have ended up in Turkey. That's prompted resentment from some of the local population, and now a warning that Syrian refugees have until midnight on Wednesday to move back to the areas where they were first registered or risk deportation back to Syria. Even before the deadline, there have been widespread claims of forced deportations by the Turkish authorities, as Mike Thompson reports.
Istanbul is thought to be home to around 500,000 Syrian refugees, but you wouldn't know it anymore. Under the current crackdown, any found by police without valid registration papers risk being deported to Syria, so most are now too frightened to walk these streets.
Abdullah, which is not his real name, wasn't registered in Istanbul, but came to find work. He'd lived happily here for 3 years, but now rarely dares leave his tiny flat.
I'm constantly living in fear of things that could happen, like being separated from my wife and deported.
It seems he has good reason to fear. Many Syrian refugees claim to have suffered that fate recently. This man, who's too frightened to be named, says he's been deported to Idlib, a war zone, an act that would breach international law.
The plans are bombing everywhere. Even schools, hospitals, everywhere there is bombs. Every day a lot of people died. There is no peace here.
After finding that he and others with him hadn't been registered in Istanbul, Turkish police ordered them all to sign a form.
I don't speak Turkish very well, so when they gave us the form, we didn't know what we signed. They said to us, you must sign on this paper. So after we signed, they led us to the border and to Idlib.
Yet despite such powerful testimonies, the Turkish government denies that any Syrian refugees have been forcibly returned. Instead, it says more than 300,000 of the country's 3.7 million refugees have gone back voluntarily. Yet according to a report by Amnesty International, the number of refugees coerced into signing voluntary return forms before being sent back to Syria is likely to run into hundreds.
Hey, Avrupa Birliği! Kendinize gelin.
Earlier this month, under pressure from growing resentment against Syrian refugees, President Erdogan gave Europe a warning. Either help Turkey establish a safe zone in North Syria for 2 million refugees, or take them yourself.
Mike Thompson reporting. Meanwhile, Turkey's recent invasion of northeastern Syria, where it hopes to resettle many of the refugees, has prompted a rebuke from politicians in the United States, with the House of Representatives voting in favour of imposing sanctions. At the same time, the House voted overwhelmingly to recognise the mass killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks during the First World War as an act of genocide. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, responded by saying the vote had no value. The BBC's Ece Göksedef told me more about the continued debate over the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Armenians more than a century ago.
Some European countries actually recognize as a genocide, and Turkey has long been denying the allegations of it has been a genocide. The bill is not binding and Ankara is aware of it. But so far, all the reactions against the European countries and also to the US has been only some reactions by statements and also some comments and speeches. And we know that Ankara is aware that the bill is actually came as a reaction to Turkey's operation in military operation in Syria. So personally, I don't think Erdogan and the Turkish parliament, Turkish government will do anything to strain the relationship between Trump and President Erdogan. And so far, Russia, of course, Armenia, and Argentina, France, Germany, Bolivia, Bulgaria, Canada, Chile, Paraguay, Luxembourg, Lebanon, Libya, and Cyprus, and Greece, and recognizes as a genocide.
So the Turkish authorities see this as coming from the House of Representatives, not from the president himself. They're not too worried, but they do acknowledge many people were killed, but they just say it wasn't a genocide. Is that the distinction they make?
Yes, definitely. And Turkey has long been calling the historians from both Turkey and Armenia and also some other international historians to get together and to find out what happened in 1915 in April. And Erdogan actually sent his condolences 2 years ago in April to all the Armenian people who were killed during these events, but they never called it as a genocide.
But it is still an issue which is going to cause tensions between Turkey and other countries.
Definitely, yes. Turkey is denying the allegations of genocide, and they know even if it's not binding, they know it's symbolically important, and it will definitely cause some tensions between the countries and Turkey.
Ece Göksedef of the BBC Turkish service. The Archbishop of York has described the damage done by oil exploitation in Nigeria as an environmental genocide. Speaking in an exclusive interview with the BBC as part of a commission investigating oil spills in the Niger Delta, John Sentamu called for an end to double standards. Our correspondent Mayeni Jones travelled with the commission earlier this year and sent this report.
I'm on a boat headed to some of the waterfront communities that have been affected by oil spills in the state of Bayelsa in the Niger Delta. One of the things that's made it difficult for authorities to investigate this in the past is how remote many of these communities are. But that's precisely why they're in need of assistance, because many of them rely on fishing for their survival.
The waterways of Bayelsa in southern Nigeria were once a thriving ecosystem, but they've been devastated by decades of oil spills.
I'm at a spill site in Oyeregbene in Bayelsa, and they say that the initial spill happened in 2014 and that since then spills keep on recurring in this area, and it's really evident in the vegetation. Everywhere is completely blackened, only the skeletons of trees left, no animal life whatsoever.
Local residents are adamant these spills are behind the death of natural life in the region.
Now the oil you drum, if you go...
It's the oil. Even if you manage to catch a fish, it's not fit to eat. There are a few that are okay, and that's what we eat. It's hard for us to feed ourselves.
I just want to say, first of all, thank you for hosting us in this, your community.
According to the Bayelsa State Oil and Environmental Commission, chaired by the Archbishop of York, oil companies are ultimately responsible for the environmental damage here. Dr. Johnson Tamu says they want to set up guidelines for oil extraction that will protect local communities.
You know, people talk about environmental degradation. I think that's too weak a phrase. For me, really, as I've looked at the environment and as I've looked at people's lives, I've come to the conclusion that this is a very slow environmental genocide, really, in the end.
But the oil companies say many spills are caused by vandals tampering with their installations. Local youth leader Warder Benjamin believes those tampering with oil pipes have their reasons.
People are hungry. People are suffering. We see crude passing through our land, and at the end, we are not beneficiaries to this national wealth. How do you expect the youth to feel? How do you expect these people to survive?
For Dr. Santamu, the environmental damage here is far from a local issue.
I may have come from Uganda. I may now be living in the United Kingdom. But we live in a global village. These are my neighbours. I'm absolutely concerned about their well-being. And when you see in the poverty, a country that produces so much oil, and you look at the conditions in which they're living, it's just shocking.
Oil spills have been happening in the Niger Delta for decades. With the attention of the international community very much elsewhere, it's unclear who will enforce the Commission's new guidelines. But if nothing changes, the prospects for future generations here are unlikely to improve.
Myeni Jones reporting from Nigeria. On Saturday, England beat New Zealand in the Rugby World Cup semi-final. But their powerful display began even before kick-off. The English players responded with defiance to the traditional pre-match challenge of the haka by the All Blacks. But they've now been fined $2,500 for overstepping the mark, as Jonathan Savage reports.
The haka is a fearsome sight. 15 mammoth rugby players chanting and gesticulating, flexing and thrusting their muscles, quaking the turf with their stomps. It's used as a challenge, a welcome, and a tribute. The haka is said to give New Zealand's All Blacks an advantage before the match has even begun. England decided they weren't going to stand there and take it. They formed an inverted V, facing and surrounding their opponents. One player, Owen Farrell, even appeared to smirk at the Kiwis. He later said, "We didn't just want to stand in a flat line and let them come at us." But now they've been fined by World Rugby, not for disrespecting the dance as such, but for overstepping the mark. Some players were standing inside the New Zealand half. New Zealand coach Steve Hansen says his team did not feel put out by the English actions.
I think their response was fantastic. They didn't get fined for responding to by doing what they did. They got fined because they went over the halfway. Now, everyone knows you're not allowed to come over the halfway, but I thought the response was brilliant. The haka requires a response. It's a challenge. I thought it was brilliant. Quite imaginative too.
Rugby bosses have been accused of hypocrisy in penalising the English. What they've breathlessly titled England's incredible response has been posted on World Rugby's YouTube page. It's been viewed more than 4 million times. This England side aren't the first team to try to out-psych New Zealand. In the past, we've seen players go eyeball to eyeball. It worked for France when they won in 2007, less so when they were defeated in the World Cup final 4 years later. The haka is supposed to end when the opponents walk away. In 2008, Wales refused to move, so the All Blacks held their ground. The referee pleaded with both teams to take up positions for kickoff, but these giants just stared at each other while the atmosphere among the Cardiff crowd built and built. After 2.5 minutes that felt like a lifetime, the All Blacks blinked. Wales had won the haka. Fat lot of good it did them, though. New Zealand won the match.
Jonathan Savage. Still to come in the podcast.
Gatwick has installed special screens where they say, OK, we are going to be boarding from the back, which obviously makes sense, but we're also going to be boarding outside in.
Is there a better way to board a plane? Iraq and Lebanon. Both nations have a significant influence from Iran, and there have been accusations that Iranian-backed gangs have attacked demonstrators. The Iranian Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has responded by blaming the United States, Israel and Saudi Arabia for the unrest.
The biggest damage enemies of a country could inflict is to deprive it of security, like you see the enemies have started doing in some countries in our region. They are depriving the people of those countries of security. The culprits for such wickedness are known.
So what's the Iranian leader trying to do with this attack on the US and its allies? I asked our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
He's trying to safeguard, to some extent, Iranian interests, which are extensive in Lebanon, obviously backing Hezbollah. In Iraq, many of the key militias are Iranian-trained, Iranian-financed. The governments, which have been predominantly Shia governments for some time, are generally getting their strongest support from Iran. And, I mean, that's what underlies this. On the surface, it's all about security. It's all about saying that, yes, the protesters have justification. You know, they are right to make their demands. But the most important thing is not to allow the security of their countries to be disrupted. And that's where the accusations begin, as you were just saying, accusing the US, accusing other Arab states he describes as regional reactionary countries. That would be particularly Saudi Arabia. And of course, Israel will be in there too, saying that they're causing. And then the language changes, talks about riots. And we've seen this on the ground, as you were saying, supporters of Hezbollah, supporters of the other main Shia movement, Amal, in Lebanon, moved in yesterday to break up protests, to destroy tents and try to open up roads in Beirut. And the worst that we've seen so far has been in Iraq, in the south, in Kerbala, where men dressed in black have been caught on video and also eyewitness accounts beating up, shooting protesters. And the protesters say that these are, again, Iranian-backed militias. So, you know, there's a big pot that's being stirred here and Iran clearly, to some extent, rattled.
Does the Ayatollah have a case to make that perhaps the US, Israel or Saudi might be involved in this, or is he just trying to undermine the protests?
I think you have to take it mainly as undermining the protests. And that, I mean, again, the leader of Hezbollah started this trend a week or so ago when he spoke out, Hassan Nasrallah, and started talking about foreign interests being behind this. And that's what the protesters have been most concerned about in both countries. But that is going to start dividing them. It's going to become sectarian when what they want to do is be united and non-sectarian.
Sebastian Usher, our Middle East analyst. Now, imagine you're about to jet off on holiday.
Mesdames et Messieurs, passagers du vol Montenegro Airlines, 2235, destination de Podgorica.
Passengers being called to board a plane in Paris-Charles de Gaulle Airport, a scene repeated around the world, heralding a slow-moving shuffle as people take their time to stow their bags and settle into their seats. But could there be a way to speed it up? Britain's second busiest airport, Gatwick, is trying to find out, as I heard from travel journalist Simon Calder.
In most parts, certainly of Europe and other parts of the world, it's very straightforward. If you are talking about a wide-bodied long-haul aircraft, then you're boarded by blocks in the economy cabin. But on short-haul, narrow-bodied planes, it's very often just a question of priority. The airline's frequent flyers will have priority. With low-cost airlines, quite often they will sell what they call is speedy boarding to get people on fast and to get their bags in the overhead lockers, and the rest of us just sort of hang around and hope that we'll find somewhere to stow our bags. So it's all a bit random at the moment.
And so what is Gatwick doing about it?
Well, of course, the crucial aspect of any short-haul, low-cost aviation operation is the turn. That's the time between the arrival on the stand and the departure. And the shorter you can get that, the more productive your aircraft, and indeed from the airport's point of view, more productive are the departure gates. But getting people on board and settled does take time, particularly if you're using an air bridge, which passengers prefer, where you walk straight from the terminal down a tunnel onto the aircraft. That's what people like to do, but it means that you get congestion. So Gatwick has installed special screens where they say, OK, we are going to be boarding from the back, which obviously makes sense, but we're also going to be boarding outside in. So the window seats first, then the middle seats, then the aisle seats last. And you look at your boarding pass and check out the screen. And that, they claim, should speed up boarding by 10%.
Do you think it will work?
Well, I fear that you'll get some people dawdling in the bar or in duty-free when they're supposed to be boarding. Other people will say, I've got a platinum card, let me through. And you'll get people like me who I'm afraid. I just always make sure I'm the last one on board because I want to scout around and see if by any chance there's two empty seats in economy together. If you really want to speed things up, the sad fact is the best way to do it is the approach by Europe's biggest low-cost airline, Ryanair, that have people board by steps at the front and the back. You just tell them, get on at the front, get on at the back. That tends to save about 5 minutes over an air bridge single door approach, but it does mean sometimes standing around in the rain.
Travel journalist Simon Calder. Asthma affects an estimated 300 million people around the world. And with increased pollution, the problem could get worse. But now researchers have found that certain inhalers leave a huge carbon footprint. And the team from the University of Cambridge suggested switching to greener medication could have a significant impact. Richard Westcott reports.
There are roughly 5.5 million people in the UK with asthma. The vast majority of them use metered dose inhalers, where you push the metal canister down and it puffs out the drug for you to inhale. But metered inhalers use potent greenhouse gases every time they're pressed. This latest research from Cambridge University suggests that if a person swaps to a greener type of inhaler, such as a dry powder or aqueous mist inhaler, it's as good for the environment as insulating their home, recycling, or cutting meat from their diet.
Richard Westcott. Now, it's an argument that's been around for some time. Are male comedians funnier than female ones? The stereotype that men are more amusing is prevalent and shared by both sexes. And now, don't shoot the messenger, a new study suggests it might actually be true. Siobhan Leahy has the details.
The 21st century has given us brilliant female comedians in abundance. Where to begin? Tina Fey, French and Saunders, Whoopi Goldberg, and of course, Joan Rivers.
All I ever heard growing up is, why can't you be like your cousin Sheila? Why can't you be like your cousin Sheila? Sheila had died at birth. They just...
This new study, done by Aberystwyth University and the University of North Carolina, isn't trying to imply that women aren't funny or that every single man on earth is funnier than their female counterpart. It's looking specifically at the ability to make other people laugh. They call it humour production ability, and they're looking at which sex does it better. The team of scientists analysed 28 different existing studies from around the world, evaluating the humour of more than 5,000 normal people, not comedians. In many of the studies they looked at, men and women were asked to write a funny caption to accompany a cartoon, and then independent judges rated their funniness without even knowing their gender. So the results? Deep breath, ladies. They found that 63% of men were funnier than the average woman. Why? Well, there could be a social and evolutionary explanation. Lead researcher Dr. Gil Greengoss told the BBC that women tend to look for a sense of humour in a partner as it's strongly correlated with intelligence. Men, on the other hand, prefer women to laugh at their jokes. That means that over our evolutionary history, men likely had to compete harder with other men to impress women with their sense of humour. Not everyone believes a study of this kind is actually helpful, though. Maddie Byes, a female comedian from the UK, she told the BBC she doesn't know why they're trying to make it a scientific fact that women aren't funny. Well, perhaps if one of my male colleagues had done this report, there'd be a better joke to end it. Instead, I'll just leave you with some more of the fabulous late Joan Rivers.
Because you have to play the game because it is a man's world. A man, he can be 95, he's a catch. We have an extra man, bring him along. He's 98, bring him, bring him. He's dead, bring him, we'll prop him.
And that report by Siobhan Leahy. That's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.